Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It's February 11th. At this hour, the governor is talking with reporters about a Hawaii Supreme Court decision that clears the way to settle claims over the deadly Maui wildfires. We get reaction from different parties. We also hear from Kimo Alameda. It's his first legislative session as Big Island mayor. We talk about his wish list as he goes before state lawmakers and works through freezes in federal funding. And laying out a strategy to deal with our shortage of healthcare workers. We often hear about the need for doctors, but we also need nurses and technicians. More on how to move forward to care for our community. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A Hawaii Supreme Court decision paves the way for the $4 billion settlement of the Maui wildfire lawsuits. At this hour, Governor Josh Green is meeting with journalists about the court's order. He spoke to HBR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo just within the last half hour about the pressure insurers may now feel to increase premiums or pull out of the market.
They made $24 billion in the last 20 years off of Hawaii's premiums. $24 billion of extra premium came in and went out. So why would anyone leave a market when it's that lucrative, which it should be less lucrative? It shouldn't be like that. There shouldn't be quite as much profit leaving our state. So they'd make a big mistake to leave. And I'm positive that other insurers, including local insurers who I've spoken with, will choose to stay.
And HBR's Ashley Mizuo also spoke to Senator Jarrett Keohokalole yesterday to get his reaction to the decision. He's introduced a bill that is being heard in committee today that would allow Hawaiian Electric to boost its credit rating by issuing bonds backed by ratepayers.
I think the concern about insurers leaving Hawaii is a real one, and it's just hard to say whether this or any single thing is the reason why. We've had insurers already pulling out. So to say that this is the reason why, you know, insurer X leaves Hawaii, I think it's a little soon to figure, to be able to tell. The ruling itself is short. There are three major parts to it, and we are still trying to comb through what the ruling actually means for insurers. I think it definitely provides some clarity and some certainty for everyone involved, which is a good thing. You know, especially on the legislative side, we were hoping to have some sort of certainty on this lawsuit while we are in session so that we can make decisions based off of it. So in that sense, I think this is a very good thing for everyone, really including the insurers. Because now we have the remainder of the legislative session to discuss what we do next.
Can you talk about some of the, you know, legislative proposals that you guys are looking at that do speak to the insurance issue and that you think people should be aware of going forward this session?
Oh, there are, at this point, dozens of bills that have been introduced and that are being heard to try and address the insurance issue. This is going to, I think, pretty significantly change the dialogue around Hawaiian Electric and around the state's share of the wildfire lawsuits and the settlement. But on the insurance side, you know, we're going to have to see how the insurers react to this ruling. You know, one of my main concerns around the bills that Hawaiian Electric is proposing is the impact on ratepayers into the future. And it was very difficult for us. You know, we're actually hearing bills on this tomorrow. And I think with the global settlement that was proposed in the summertime still being in flux because of this appeal, it was very difficult for us to commit to long-term impacts based off of some of these bills for ratepayers. So if we were to, at the legislative level, pass major pieces of legislation that commit ratepayers to help rehabilitate the creditworthiness of Hawaiian Electric so that it can borrow on better terms in the long run to do wildfire hardening, which is one of the bills that's being proposed, it was really difficult to see whether that was in the ratepayers' best interest or not when there was no resolution on their wildfire liability. You know, so I think that's a significant change, is that now that it appears that the high court has ruled on this settlement and it's going to proceed, that is a major area of risk for Hawaiian Electric that's essentially going to be resolved. So now we can look to the future. What do we need as taxpayers in Hawaii and as ratepayers? What do we need out of our utility that has just cleared this wildfire liability? And, you know, what are they asking for to make sure that they're in the best position at the cheapest rate to consumers to not have these tragedies happen again? And to make sure that our grid is, you know, stable and as inexpensive as possible going forward.
And Hawaiian Electric said in a statement that the court's decision moves the settlement forward and provides greater clarity for all parties, including Hawaiian Electric, helping to reestablish the financial stability needed to invest in a resilient and sustainable future for our customers and our state. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Jesse Creed, liaison counsel for the plaintiffs in the case. One of the key legal questions the state Supreme Court answered was about subrogation, a maneuver that could have allowed insurance companies to sue Hawaiian Electric to recover insurance policy payouts. The court found that insurers' rights to subrogation was limited by state law. Creed says the ruling is an unambiguous win for his clients.
This is a complete and total victory for the settlement. Yes, the settlement is going to happen. The people of Maui who are the victims of the fire are going to get swift justice, swifter than any wildfire before, because the settlement happened within a year of the fire happening, which is unprecedented. It's an extraordinary result. It's the best possible deal that could happen under these circumstances. Is everyone going to get paid every penny that they lost? No, that's probably not going to happen. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality given how small in resources some of these defendants who caused the fire are.
The settlement was reached a year after the fires. When's the earliest that victims could receive financial compensation from the settlement?
I think it's ambitious, but possible for people to get their first check by the end of this year or early next year. There are still a lot of steps that remain. This victory at the Hawaii Supreme Court for the people of Maui is the first step in the process to make sure that this settlement is going to happen. And the Hawaii Supreme Court said what Hawaii law clearly says. This was not a difficult or complex issue, in my view. It was simple and straightforward. And the insurers simply refused to accept and acknowledge what Hawaii law requires. And they were trying to make a money grab to get more money from their premium paying policyholders.
And I know the ball's not exactly in your court with respect to this, but do you get the sense that the insurers will try to appeal this decision or ask for it to be reconsidered?
They can try, but there's nowhere to go from here. They could try to appeal it all the way up to the United Nations if they want to, but now, after the Hawaii Supreme Court, it's a state law issue, and it's an entirely local state law issue about Hawaii law. The United States Supreme Court does not address state law issues. The United States Supreme Court only addresses federal issues. And so that would be, they could potentially, you know, try to seek certiorari or petition the Supreme Court to weigh in, the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in. But that is never going to happen. And that is a true moonshot. So that's why, you know, there's no appeal to the United Nations, but I'm being facetious when I say if they want to, they could appeal it all the way up to the United Nations, and it's not going to change this result.
And so next steps, the case goes back down to Peter Cahill, the circuit court judge. And what does it look like to get from there to finalizing the settlement?
So there's a lot of work that needs to happen to figure out how to fairly divide up the $4 billion among these extraordinary losses of people who suffered a great deal. And that will be the work of what we call claims administrators, these independent, fair people who have experience in doing this kind of analysis. And they make an independent and fair determination for the people of Maui. And so that's what needs to happen. That work needs to happen.
And one of the big questions there is of contingency fees. So how much do lawyers like yourself get? What do you think is a fair rate of compensation?
Well, I think every victim has their own private agreement with the lawyers. And so, you know, I think what's fair is what was agreed to between the lawyer and the victim. But I don't really have an opinion on that.
Can you share what it would be for you?
I actually do not know, and I'm not lying about that. I do not know. I handle the interface with the courts and you know, the defendants, and I'm sort of the liaison counsel. We have a team here who handle a lot of our intake and bring people in and set them up. And so I actually do not know the answer to that. But I think I know that the contingency fees across the island have gone down over time. And so I think there's some fee percentage that most people have generally agreed to. I just don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm. Last question for you of just final reactions and what you feel like the impact will be, the precedent that this sets for Hawaii and potentially nationwide.
Well, I think the impact is that the settlement will happen. Money will get to the people of Maui more quickly to help them rebuild their community. That's the most important thing, to help them fill the gap to the extent that it can. That was left as a result of the losses from the fire. Across Hawaii and the country, I know there's a lot of talk about insurance premiums, but I think that's a misleading talking point of the insurance industry. Premiums are based on future risk. They're not based on things that happened in the past. But yes, the fact that the fire happened and caused extraordinary losses, that will impact people's premiums because insurers will account for that. But the fact that the fact that they don't recover every dollar they paid out, the insurers don't account for that. They look into the future, and it's based on future risk. And they price the premium based on the future risk.
That was HPR's Maddie Bender and attorney Jesse Creed, who represented the proponents of the global settlement. The property insurers for Hawaii released a statement on behalf of more than 160 insurance companies involved in the lawsuit. It reads in part, "We are disappointed in the Hawaii Supreme Court's ruling and believe this sets a troubling precedent." Bender spoke with Michael Wara to understand the potential impact on Hawaii's insurance industry. Wara is a lawyer and director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford University. He says this isn't the first time that Hawaii has weathered an insurance crisis.
Certainly Hawaii has had problems in the past, particularly after Hurricane Iniki, that, you know, folks may remember did terrible damage to the south shore of Kauai. So Hawaii is not unfamiliar with having to kind of prop up the market for a while insurers regain comfort with it. I don't know that this will rise to that level for Hawaii, but it's happening in a context where insurance markets everywhere are strained. Reinsurance, which is kind of insurance for insurance companies, is more expensive and less available than it used to be. And so it's sort of putting an additional strain on an already strained situation. Hopefully, insurance remains available and also affordable in Hawaii after this catastrophe. That, you know, it's both things, because you can have insurance that's available, but it's so astronomically expensive that it's not very helpful to anyone because they can't afford to buy it and pay their mortgage. Or you can have, like what we've been having in California, a situation where the insurers just pull back from the market and are not willing to sell new policies. And that happens usually when the insurance regulator won't allow prices to be charged that are high enough for the insurers to feel comfortable with covering their costs and earning a reasonable profit. That's a risk in this context. It's hard for me, though, to say, you know, in the abstract, because this is not an abstract question. This is about like, where are the insurers now? What are their capital cushions? What were they assuming about subrogation recovery from these responsible parties or the parties to the settlement that are contributing to the settlement, whatever you want to call that? Because they probably did not admit fault. If the insurers had kind of baked in some sort of subrogation recovery, maybe they recover half of what they paid out, then this would be a big shock to their balance sheets, and it might cause them to pull back from the market at least for some time. If they had not counted on that, and this would have sort of been a nice bonus for their balance sheets, then maybe things are fine in Hawaii. And I think it really just depends on how the major primaries that write a lot of the business, and I'd emphasize it, what really matters is kind of the market leaders and how they respond, what they do.
Another question I had is, what should lawmakers be weighing right now?
Well, so one thing to say is there's no free lunch in all of this, right? The real solution is reducing risk as much as you can, the different kinds of risk that are potentially in play in Hawaii, which are, you know, a broad set of issues, right? You've got lava risk, but you also have tropical cyclone risk. Now we know that you have wildfire risk to deal with in certain parts of Hawaii. And so a key step that state lawmakers have a lot of control over is, what are the building codes? What are the land use and zoning codes? How do we manage those so that there is less risk to insure, right? Insurance is really just transferring risk from the person that has it to somebody else in exchange for some money. And it's easier to deal with that if you have less risk to transfer. And so that's a key step. And so one question to be asking is, are there things in the high wildfire risk areas of Hawaii that could be done to reduce the chances that something like Lahaina ever happens again? I think already those kinds of things are happening. On my understanding is that, you know, the management of guinea grass, particularly around communities, is in a really different place than it was prior to the fire, which is a great thing. It's also true that, you know, and we're talking about this in California, changing rules around how people's backyards look can do a lot to prevent an urban conflagration like what happened in Lahaina from occurring, even in high winds. In terms of short-term interventions in the insurance market, Hawaii has a history of being really smart about this, in the sense that they kind of do the least amount of intervention that they can for the shortest time possible, and try to steer the system back toward a place where the state government doesn't need to be involved. There's not this kind of like what we have now in California, where all policyholders are going to pay for the losses from the insurer of last resort, the FAIR plan in California. It's better to have a small FAIR plan. It's better to have a FAIR plan where people are temporary visitors to that plan and not permanent residents. Once people kind of settle into being a permanent, you know, permanently insured by the insurer of last resort, that's accumulating risk in the system that someone is ultimately going to have to pay.
Moving back, kind of wrapping up on the topic of the settlement, since you played a role in the PG&E settlement and the fallout of the wildfires in California, do you feel like this settlement in Hawaii turned out differently, and whom is it benefiting more?
I think the settlement in Hawaii is much better for Lahaina fire victims than the PG&E settlement was for PG&E victims. And the reason is that the Lahaina fire victims are going to get cash. And in the PG&E context, they got shares in the company that had done them grievous harm, which was both upsetting, frankly, and also meant that they were locked up in the future health, financial health of this company, and they couldn't get their money out very quickly. So I think it's a better settlement. And that's especially true because in the California context, the insurance companies got cash and the victims got shares. And many of us objected at the time to that because the average victim that has lost their home and maybe more than their home isn't like well positioned to wait while shares go up in value. Whereas an insurance company, that's kind of what they do, right? Like they invest the money you pay them in premiums while they wait to have to pay claims. And so it didn't feel fair, but that was the settlement we had in California, and it had to do with the order in which the settlements occurred. So I think it's better. I don't know if we systematically lock insurance companies out of the ability to subrogate against especially electric utilities that have caused many of the most damaging fires in the Western United States. I'm not sure what would happen if this became sort of a generalized pattern. It would certainly raise insurance costs for everyone, which might be worth it. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just, it probably would happen. Nobody makes out well after a catastrophic wildfire. Your life is just never going to be the same. But at least Lahaina victims in what must seem like a long time to them, but in a relatively short period of time, if you look at other fires, are getting their money so that they can have finality over what they're going to get and then rebuild their life in Lahaina or somewhere else. And I think that's a really good thing.
A really good thing. That was Stanford climate and energy policy professor Michael Wara talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. Look for more coverage of the Supreme Court's decision and the Maui wildfire settlement on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
When a crowd gets too dense, all those people and their combined tonnage start to move as a unit.
500 people in your back, it's basically 10 tons. And if you have a pressure of 10 tons pushing you against the wall, I think it's very dangerous.
Hear from researchers who think they found a way to disperse crowds before they become dangerous. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat is carrying a powerful story. It's the backstory, really, from families affected by the fires. Project's editor Jessica Terrell has been digging through court filings and joins us now. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Gosh, you know, your headline alludes to these are stories that these survivors really won't tell in open court, right?
Yeah, so last month, about 40 wildfire survivors were set to testify in a trial over compensation. It was a bit unusual in that in a lot of these big class action lawsuits, the victims don't actually ever get up and tell their own story. That trial was sort of averted the last minute, but as a part of the court filings, it was a 119-page document with more than three dozen stories from people who either had lost a family member in the fire or who had survived the fire themselves in, you know, kind of the most horrific of circumstances possible. It was really, I think, one of the most comprehensive kind of collections of people's stories of survival and how they're doing now in their own words.
Yes, and, you know, I have to admit, when I read this early this morning, I got a lump in my throat because, you know, reading an account by someone who was with neighbors in the water, and they were in the water for like, oh gosh, what was it, 9 or 11 hours. I talked to one of those people, and, you know, to hear them describe, you know, what they went through being in the water like that, waiting for someone to rescue them, oh, it was just so, so traumatic.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there that's very hard to read. But it is really powerful to hear it from people's own voices. And I think it's important because, you know, as we go forward right now with the wildfire settlement, the idea is, you know, to kind of make people's lives whole. And people's lives will never be made whole from this. You know, there's an 87-year-old woman who's talking about seeing kind of the last glimpse of Lahaina 5 days after the fire as she flew away, knowing she was never going to go back to the home that she had built with her husband in the 1960s, where she'd nursed him through cancer, and sort of the impossibility of restarting life after that. But the other thing for me, I think, that was a takeaway from reading through all of these was how even in the worst of this tragedy, there were so many examples of kind of the best of humanity, so many stories of people in this community stopping and helping somebody and saving somebody's life when there was nobody else around to help. And that, to me, was a pretty powerful takeaway. The woman who had a seven-day-old baby, and she was in a car with her child and her parents, and the car broke down on Front Street. The car in front of them caught on fire, and she was just convinced that that was the end. She was going to die. And another family stopped and managed to fit all five people into their car and get them to the Civic Center. You know, it's just one example of so many where people really helped each other get through and survive this.
Yes, I mean, they were just people in need. They were neighbors. They were strangers. But boy, after this experience, yeah, you just think, thank goodness that there are people out there who are willing to help.
Yeah, willing to help strangers. A woman, I think another one of the ones that was really moving to me was a story of a kapuna who was in the water and didn't really know how to swim, and a young man she'd never met stayed with her the whole night, making sure that she was okay. The other thing that I think is an important takeaway from this testimony is it also gives us a glimpse of how people are doing now and where they are. A lot of these testimonies, which were basically people writing and saying, if I was called on to testify, this is what I would say. I mean, they were filed from different parts of Hawaii, but also Maryland and Nevada and places where people have had to go because they can't find the mental health services for their children with autism after the fire, or stable housing, or, you know, other parts of their lives were just disrupted, or they simply can't handle being in a place anymore where they lost their loved ones and their entire sense of self.
Yes, you know, I think the fact that one of those family members just said, you know, I've got to move on and make my life in another area for my family, my family's future. But very powerful. Thank you so much, Jessica, for bringing this to light.
Thanks for having us on.
And that was Jessica Terrell talking to us about Sybil Beats' lead story. It was about families affected by the insurance settlement. Read the story online at sybilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Par Hawaii, committed to producing renewable fuels for Hawaii's airlines, electric utilities, and other industries. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
The richest person in the world is taking control of the federal government's payment systems, shutting down agencies, and reshaping Washington.
I think the function of government under Trump, under Elon Musk, will not be to serve ordinary people, but to make the very richest people in this country even richer.
The President and the Plutocrat. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
It is Kimo Alameda's turn driving the bus for the Big Island. He and other mayors are laying out their ass for their respective counties as they go before state lawmakers, making the case for the needs of their residents. We talked to Mayor Alameda this morning.
You know, one ask is to consider our Banyan Drive revitalization bill that proposes to move the authority over out of DLNR to Department of Tourism. And so that's one. You know, so there's ask on our aquifer out in Pona, our Ota Wells. So our ask basically fall upon what I call five big legislative priorities or domains. One is wastewater. So any wastewater legislation that will help us provide funding for our wastewater system, which includes cesspool conversion. We are in full support of that. The other pillar, if you will, is housing. Any affordable housing bills, we are in full support of that. There's some bills that, two bills in particular, that makes the permitting process easier. I believe that's House Bill 1405 and 1406, and that's something that we support as well. And then there's, you know, bills that help our ag industry, one that provides funding to help with the coconut rhinoceros, ag theft. So these bills, you know, these areas are important to us. These are the, you know, infrastructure bills like roads. If there's any bills that support funding for our alternate route, we missed the boat last administration on that. So if there's any bills that will support that, we are in. Any bills that help provide funding to alleviate traffic congestion, we are in full support. So we're hoping for the best. You know, it's tough because the federal government now has put a freeze on some of our federal funding. So we don't know how that will play out. And so we got to wait and see.
There were sizable amounts of money that were in line for Hawaii to get under the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Any indication that those have been paused at all?
I'm not sure, actually. We're still waiting to hear how it plays out.
I'm sure that's a concern, just this uncertainty when you have so many critical projects that need to get funded to see it through.
Absolutely. I mean, the big departments I can think of right off the bat is our transportation, which is mostly federal funded. Our housing department is over 90% federal funded. I mean, it's going to be a big shakeup if we don't get that funding released.
Have you had the conversation with the county council about what if that pipeline gets shut off?
Yes, we did. Not in a full county council, but in conversation back and forth. So, you know, every day I go home and the first thing I do is I turn on the news. I look at all channels just in case. And it's the same. It's President Trump is really serious in his freeze of federal funding. And that's going to hurt us.
Well, we know things change day by day. The Attorney General and Lopez has filed a number of suits along with other attorneys general and other states. You know, it's all an effort to put a stay on some of these moves just because there needs to be some kind of orderly transition as opposed to just turning off the spigot.
I agree. It's hard to decipher what is just rhetoric and what is for real. But at this point, I'm just taking it all for real so we can be prepared. Yeah.
Yes. And we did talk to a number of social service agencies who are also very nervous about funding because they don't have much wiggle room to float payroll, let's say. They do employ a number of people who are vital to things like dealing with our homeless crisis.
Absolutely.
Have you had any conversations with agencies over there?
Again, just in passing, they are very nervous. These are the social service provider agencies that even our health providers, I mean, they also get federal funding. You know, our federal qualified health center gets federal funding. So this will definitely hurt all of us. So I hope it's rhetoric. I don't know why our president would be so drastic in his approach to cut the deficit. I don't understand sometimes.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people that are on edge just because there is so much uncertainty. But is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know, you know, as you start off this term?
Well, I want the listeners to know that at the county level, you know, we are maximizing everything we have, every authority that I have to make life easier for our county residents. I am there. I'm at every meeting, you know, that everything I have, we have control over, you know, myself and our team. We are maximizing that. So we have created 5 task force. You know, one task force is on permitting. So we have already found strategies to speed up the permitting process. You know, we have control over that. And I'm very excited about our task force made up of both county and community folks and construction workers and architects. Our second task force is on housing and homelessness. And I believe we have control over that, you know, for now. And so we are maximizing and leveraging our, you know, local networks and some that doesn't have to do with the federal government. And I'm very happy about that too. Our other task force is on animal control. And again, that's something that's in our control. I believe we just need to coordinate better and start to bring in the nonprofits and look at practices that worked in the past. And I'm talking goats, pigs, you know, sheep, kind of like one group, and then cats, dogs, another group. And now there's chickens. So, you know, I believe that's more in our control than the feds or the state. So I'm also happy about that task force. The other two task force, you know, on cesspool conversion, that's going to require some federal funding. But we do have some federal partners that can help us with that as well.
I did see a story recently about how there were dye tests that were conducted, and the concern was that some of the wastewater was, you know, moving in areas faster than anyone thought. And so that's something that needs to be taken a closer look at.
Oh, absolutely. We would have a very proactive approach right now in handling our wastewater situation, especially the Hilo coastline. So the Hilo wastewater treatment facility, I mean, you know, it was built back in 1993. That's a little over 30 years ago. And it serves over 30,000 residents. And, you know, today I'm going to be signing off on an emergency proclamation that will help us in case there's a break along the shoreline, the pump stations, or at headworks at the facility. You know, we can respond immediately. That emergency proclamation will allow us to suspend certain laws like procurement laws that help us to respond quickly. So, you know, and again, that's the things that we can do that's in our control. So I want the Big Island residents to know that, you know, hey, everything that's in under our control, which is a lot, we're maximizing that and making sure that services continue to be provided and that public safety is still paramount.
Well, you know, we did have the former EPA Region 9 administrator here, you know, on our show. And I know that she has said that it's one of the worst in the country as far as the shape that it's in. And so there's, yeah, great concern because we don't really want to be hit with any violations for the Clean Water Act.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our engineers have noted, you know, mechanical defects, structural deterioration, extensive corrosion. I mean, you name it. Yeah, it is. I would agree. I think it is the worst in the country. And that's why I'm surprised the prime administration did not enact an emergency proclamation, especially since it's something that is keeping us up at night. You know, I mean, we need a plan. And so we do have a plan. That's part of the emergency proclamation. I had my team go out and look at, you know, I thought, give me the three what ifs. You know, if it breaks here, what's the plan? If it breaks there, what's the plan? And if it breaks at another place, what's the plan? So I just want the Big Island residents to know that public safety is our number one concern, and not just, you know, for one side of the island, but the whole island, yeah.
Are there any additional or separate asks to the state legislature to help deal with that facility?
I spoke to the governor yesterday. You know, he assured us that if there are any funds that is earmarked for wastewater, that we would get some. Because, you know, how we fund this is through bonds. And bonds is like a big credit card. $337 million is what's going to cost us for this particular project at the Keokaha Wastewater Treatment Facility. And so when you maximize your credit card, you don't have anything else. You know, basically, you cannot provide any more projects. You know, you're stuck. You're done. So if we could offset some of this, you know, with federal funds or state funds, then that allows us to have funds for county-specific projects, you know, like parks, fields, gyms, beaches.
On the subject of animal control, I know you chuckled when you mentioned chickens, but, you know, we are grappling with lots of uncertainty with the avian flu. And so I think our last conversation, we talked about the goats and the pigs, because I believe it was your daughter got into an accident there on Saddle Road with a feral animal. But yeah, public safety is paramount.
Absolutely. And that's part of our task force. You know, we met with the state transportation. We met with Pualkaloa training facility. We met with DLNR. And, you know, we talked about the traffic vehicle collision situation up at Saddle Road, you know, where my daughter got into an accident hitting a pig. And I mean, I have a friend who took out a couple of sheep, as well as his vehicle was totally smashed. It's a big public health situation here. And so, you know, we do have some ideas, some strategies. There is, we are considering AI, where there's a device that, you know, if there's a game, you know, sheep, goats, pigs in the area, it flashes a light, you know, kind of like a stop line flashlight. So it allows the vehicles to be aware that, oh, there might be animals in the area. So kind of slow down. So, you know, those kind of low-hanging strategies, I think, are things that us at the county, we can do. You know, we don't have to wait for the feds for that.
That was Mayor Kimo Alameda talking to us this morning about his priorities this legislative session. He just officially signed an emergency proclamation in case the Big Island sewage treatment plant fails. The EPA has called that aging facility one of the worst in the country.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend, HPR presents the Malie Lyman Quartet. This concert is a part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. The Malie Lyman Quartet is performing this Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
You know, at the start of this year, the Healthcare Association of Hawaii released a key report about workforce development. It essentially boils down where the job shortages are in our hospitals and healthcare facilities. For the last 6 years or so, the association has surveyed its members to get hard data so that we as a state could identify the gaps in training programs available locally. We start off by hearing from Nevaeh Marcelino, a Big Island college student attending the University of Hawaii Hilo campus, who is also working as a nurse aide at Queens North Hawaii Community Hospital.
I had a lot of caregiving responsibilities while I was growing up, and that's what set me towards healthcare.
And so how are you making this all work? Because you're still going to school, and yet you've got this, you know, very practical experience.
It's funny how everyone asks me how I make it work. To be honest, I don't know how I make it work. I go to school 5 days a week. When I have time in between, I study, of course. And on the weekends, I try to make the most of my time to get into work. And I feel like I need to keep going to keep going. If not, I tend to get lazy.
I don't know about lazy. That was Nevaeh Marcelino, who is working at Queens North Hawaii Community Hospital as a nurse aide while attending UH Hilo. She got a head start in high school and says down the road, she may consider advancing her career in obstetrics or pediatrics. You know, this morning we talked to two people from the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, Jana Hoshide, Vice President of Workforce Development, and CEO Hilton Rathel. The workforce survey gave us a snapshot of our healthcare needs, apart from the shortage of physicians. But the doctor shortage is a story for another day. But Rathel starts us off.
We realized that this gap that existed, where basically the educational institutions in Hawaii or the educational sector basically operated pretty independently, with only ad hoc communication between educational institution and healthcare, that was not sufficient because there was no direct communication in terms of tailoring programs to what the employers needed and in terms of the actual demand in certain sectors. Do we need more doctors? Do we need more nurses? Or what are all those relevant needs? So what we decided to do is do the first in the state statewide network, and we did a demand survey. So we went out to all of these different healthcare organizations across the state, wide variety of healthcare organizations. And for the first report, which came out in 2019, we identified 76 patient-facing healthcare professions. And we said, okay, for all of these institutions that we interviewed, how many vacancies do you have? What's your turnover rate? How difficult is it to fill these positions? We got all that information. We put it all together and then created a report that put out there. And then we went to our educational institutions, public high schools, community colleges, and universities, and said, look, this is what the data is telling us. We all know there's workforce shortages in the state of Hawaii. We don't have the luxury of educational institutions just basically training a bunch of people based on budgets they have or interests they have or classrooms they have, and then just, you know, hope or assume that these people are going to get jobs. So this, at its core, is all about matching supply and demand. What is the demand in Hawaii for all of these healthcare professions? And then how do we increase the supply or adjust the supply over time so that it better matches the demand?
We really can't afford to be operating in silos at all anymore.
No, we absolutely cannot. And so when we started this report, our goal was to reproduce a report every 2 years. We decided that a two-year interval is a good time. So we're producing the report roughly every 2 years. Right now, we have three reports, our 2019 report, our 2022 report, and then in January of this year, we released our 2024 report. And these reports have become critical in terms of employers, the healthcare industry, identifying what the needs are, and they can see what the needs are across the state, across each island. We do the island breakdowns, and we do the state, you know, obviously aggregated at the state level. And then the educational institutions, whether public high schools, community colleges, universities, they can look at that and say, okay, so what do we do with that? Now, one of the things that came out of our 2019 report is that we knew that we didn't have a physical therapy program here in the state of Hawaii. They knew anecdotally we had a shortage, but we didn't have a documented shortage. And the 2019 report documented what the statewide shortage is for physical therapists. And so we, one of our local institutions, looked at that report, actually two of them did, and said, look, this is something that we're interested in. One program has already been started, physical therapy in the state of Hawaii. They're already training students, and there's another program starting up as well. So that's one specific example of where this very specific data led an educational institution to create a brand new program to provide opportunities for students in Hawaii who are interested in physical therapy. What was happening previously is that someone wanted to go to physical therapy, they had to go to the mainland to get their training. And we know that if people go to the mainland and are studying for 3, 4, 5 years, whatever it is on the mainland, they may meet someone over there, they may find a job over there, they may just say, look, I want to be in this different place, whatever right. it is, I like the climate, whatever. Every time we send people to the mainland to get trained, we're going to lose a material number of those for all those reasons. And so by having as many programs as possible in the state of Hawaii, it gives us the opportunity to provide jobs in the state of Hawaii and meet the needs that all of our healthcare institutions have.
I want to bring Jana in now. You know, can you say where we have made some progress just as you look back at these surveys?
Across our three reports, it's been fairly consistent in terms of the largest needs, and those have been really in entry-level positions and in nursing. And so together they account for more than 70% of the job openings. And so we've been working on three strategies to really address those needs. And the first is really about attracting more students into the health services pathway, as well as creating more opportunities to train them, certify them, and employ them. And then the second is really around attracting and retaining those workers through glide paths. And so glide paths are earn and learn progression programs. They enable someone to continue to work and earn a living while they go to school at the same time. And in many cases, like a CNA to LPN, they can increase their salary potential by 50%. And then the third strategy is really around expanding transition to specialty programs. And so we've worked closely with the Hawaii State Center for Nursing. And as a result, we have expanded nurse residency programs, as well as nurse transition to specialty practice. And so what we're seeing is that the demand and the openings for these nurse specialty positions have decreased, and in critical areas such as ICU nurses. That's a really amazing outcome of some of these programs. So if you don't mind, I wanted to touch on some of the programs at the entry level. I know you spoke with Nevea recently.
Yes. What else are you offering?
So we know that about 49% of Hawaii high school students aren't going on to college immediately following graduation. And so what we want to do is let students know that there are jobs available in healthcare at all education levels. And so they can actually get certified in high school and start their career immediately after graduating.
I was surprised at the number. It was like 49%, 48%?
Yeah, 49%. So that's pretty high. And so one of our workforce programs is to train high school seniors for those high demand jobs that are stated in the report. So certified nurse aides, medical assistants, phlebotomists, patient service representatives. But what's great about our program is that the student, in addition to being certified in these professions, we also work with them on employment support. So they learn how to fill out a job application, what it means to be professional, and how to prepare for the interview. Also, the employers participating provide additional support to the students. And so as a result, our program was offered in 14 high schools last year, and 98% of them completed the program. We had over 100 students, and 75% of them were hired and able to start their healthcare career journey. So this was just like Nevea. She participated as a senior in the medical assistant program at Honoka'a High School, and then she was able to secure her first job as a nurse aide at Queens North Hawaii Community Hospital.
Hilton, I don't know, when you see then the gains that you've made over the span of, 5 years, right, or so, there's still a lot more work to be done, but at least we're making some progress.
Well, we're definitely making progress, which is good. As we know, the pandemic had a devastating impact on the state and on our workforce, and the need went up because we were taking care of so many more sick people during the pandemic on top of all the normal things you take care of in all of our healthcare institutions. Now, the good news is that our census levels in our hospitals have decreased from the very high levels they're at during the pandemic, but at the same time, we also have all these programs that we're working on, and this is a statewide collaboration. We're working with number of public high schools across the state. We're working with all the community colleges. We're working with all the universities in the state. And so we are working collectively and with our members, as we're getting a lot of support from hospitals, long-term care, our other members who are providing training opportunity. They're helping doing these interviews that Jana was talking about. So this is truly a multi-organizational collaboration to improve the supply of healthcare workers. And the great thing is that we're tailoring these programs to say, okay, well, as the demand changes, it may go up, it may go down, we can then make adjustments. And, you know, if we're training 100 students in one area, you know, for 1 year, 2 years from now, we may say, okay, well, the demand has come up a little bit, so we can scale down that, but we can scale up another program. So this type of data helps us be much more efficient, helps us be much more effective in, again, matching supply and demand so that we can better meet the needs of all the residents here in Hawaii.
Any final thoughts that you want to share, Jenna, about what we've done and where we need to go?
We do need more glide paths and more earn and learn opportunities. We're really grateful that UH Maui College created the first CNA to LPN glide path. And so that has really made an impact on our LPN demand. And it's a different model. So it's a very close partnership with employers. And employees get to stay at their employer while they're progressing to LPN. And so in the past 2 years, there have been over 60 students that graduated from the program. And we're excited because there are 50 more in the program this year. So as you can see, this enables students like Nevea to continue her career pathway and continue to earn and learn as she progresses both her career and her salary. And we feel like there's such a need for more of these opportunities. Originally, we had created them for folks who are new to the workforce, like Nevea. But over time, we found that there are CNAs that had been working for 10 or 20 years who always had dreams of going into nursing and just didn't have the opportunity because they needed to continue to work. And so it's really nice to see that these programs are helping folks to fulfill their dreams, but also helping employers to retain their employees so that they can continue to provide care for the community.
Care for the community, that is key. We've been hearing from Hilton Rathel and Jana Hoshide from the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. We also heard from UH Hilo College student Nevea Marcelino, who is well on a solid career in healthcare. You go, girl. We are rooting for you. Well, that does it for us for today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about funding for the state's climate initiatives. And we check in with Honolulu Mayor Rick Langiardi about his top priorities for the city. Got questions for the mayor? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.